Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Thank you so much, everybody. I appreciate you being here. And we're set up for a wonderful show today. It is time to talk about the weather. And despite the multiple pronunciations, our guest today is Jerry Stenger. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here with us.
My pleasure.
It's not always easy to get a climatologist in the room.
Well, meteorologists seem to be all over the place, and a lot of times when people find out I work with the weather, they want to know what TV station I do the weather reports for, or what the weather's doing at the time. But climatologist tends to look at a little bit different picture than a meteorologist. We tend to be more focused on larger scale processes or processes that are analyzed over a longer period of time.
So let's do that. Jerry Stenger, Director of the Climatology Office at UVA's Department of Environmental Science, a very long title, difficulty fitting that on your business card, right? But let's break into that big question right away. Define the difference between climatology versus weather in 2, 3, 4 sentences.
Well, it's also funny because that's a question that gets asked of us a lot. And we usually look at each other and say, how do we exactly explain that? Because there's a huge amount of overlap between the two. A climatologist has to understand meteorology, and a meteorologist has to have some focus on climatology at the same time. But I'll give you an example. If somebody wanted to analyze the effects of local terrain on temperature variations, that would be a climatology question. A meteorologist might look at a particular storm, a particular hurricane, a particular thunderstorm even, and look at all the data he has from instrumentation he put up in it and analyze that particular event. That's a good example of the difference between the two. Very different scales, often both in time and space.
But when you do that, did I hear that correctly, that, or did I imagine that the meteorologist went to school for a more short-term version of weather in a smaller, or the climatologist got a different, I just have this, like, two-dimension, three-dimension, length of time sort of thing, you know, the meteorologist got so that they can predict it for the 7-day, 10-day bit of weather, and the climatologist is trying to do it for the 10-year sort of thing.
Not necessarily. In the case,
not to make fun of the guy on Channel 29 doing the weather.
Not at all.
It's just doing their job.
That's not necessarily an easy thing to do.
Because everybody gets yelled at if it's wrong.
Well, if you want to make weather forecasts, you cannot have a thin skin. You have to be willing to be wrong because it's going to work out like that. We don't have a perfect way of understanding what the weather is going to be. And for weather forecasting, which we would talk about the forecasting out to, say, 10 days, we rely on weather forecast models that are run by the National Weather Service. They gather data from around the world. They use surface data that's gathered about every hour from many stations. And every 12 hours, weather balloons go up around the world. And they take upper air measurements. So they have these models that they run where they take all the data and put it in there. And it calculates what a parcel of air is likely to do based on the principles of physics and come out with a diagrammatic representation of what they think certain aspects of the weather will be. Now, there's a huge amount of effort that goes into interpreting this information. And, for instance, some forecasters will have a different way of analyzing that information and getting pieces implications for what that's going to be. And that's why you'll sometimes see different weather forecasts coming from different entities, because there's a lot behind the curtain on weather forecasting. I teach a course in that in the UVA's Lifetime Learning Institute, and one of the things I try to get across to my students is there's no correct way to forecast. And climatologists aren't necessarily looking out longer term. For the most part, climatologists are what we would call data people. Actually, there's data people and there's modeling people. Now, data people, like myself, look at information we already have and glean ideas about what's happening with that. Like we might look at the nighttime low temperatures in this part of Virginia and relate that to the elevation and be able to explain to a vintner, for instance, where he might want to plant his most sensitive grapes or not based on the way the cold air drains at night. So we do a lot of general things based on the data. So I'm a statistical climatologist in that sense for the most part. Though I do make weather forecasts, but my great nemesis is the forecast for graduation ceremonies.
Really? So the university comes to you and says,
yes.
What are we looking at? Should we be inside JPJ or outside on the lawn?
Yes, and it's often the case where, well, the president's going to be giving a presentation on thus and such, and they want to do it outside. And the last thing I want to do is have the president get rained on unexpectedly. I'm not saying that has never happened, but I will say that I've been very fortunate in a lot of that. For instance, at graduation, that hasn't been held inside since, I believe, 1976. So they are very, very eager to keep that on the lawn. And now, of course, there are two consecutive days of graduation. The odds of having two consecutive days without rain in this part of Virginia is probably about 2-1 in favor of rain. So we're, this does make things a little trickier, but so far I've been able to talk everybody around the thunderstorms and such. But a couple of times I've had to tell the person who's directing everything to give the speaker the cut and run sign. And it's, okay, so thank you very much. You guys have a great time. I confer all degrees. Goodbye.
Our guest today, Jerry Stinger from the Climatology Office. He's the director at University of Virginia. We're talking weather here at WPVC. Thanks very much for being with us, Jerry. So, one of the interesting things when I was doing my homework for today's show, everybody thinks about predicting and looking forward, and we were just talking about that. I'm sure we'll talk some more about that throughout the hour. But it was also looking in the past, and you used the phrase when we were preparing out in the lobby But it was
forensic climatology.
Forensic climatology. It was helping lawyers, helping the police. Talk a little bit about that.
A lot of times I'm approached by people who have had a particular problem that has a weather aspect to it, and they want to know more about what was the weather at that time and in terms of how that may have affected what's going on. Sometimes it's a very simple case like was it ice on the ground when somebody slipped and fell? How long had it been since it snowed before the sidewalks are cleared? Things like that. Fairly straightforward stuff. In some cases, like in one case, I was involved in what became sort of a landmark case in Virginia about flooding in an area in northern Virginia in relation to the design of culverts and other water handling facilities that VDOT had put in place at one point, and what the liabilities were based on the extremity, how extreme an event was that occurred that caused quite a bit of flooding to a lot of homes, and had to go back and pull up all kinds of information, live it radar information and such, and then go back and look at the historical record and the statistics involving that to see how unusual that event was and to what extent either side could have been held, might have been held liable for the events that occurred. So that wound up being a lot of preparation and a lot of testimony regarding that. And, that was actually very interesting, a little stressful sometimes, but I find things like that very interesting. I'll just add that the example I use is the old Mickey Mouse Club. I believe Friday was what they called Anything Can Happen Day. Well, in my office, every day is Anything Can Happen Day. I never know what's going to happen when the phone rings or when I get an email from somebody, and it's one of the things that keeps the job so fascinating. Sometimes very stressful, but nonetheless fascinating, because there's always some new aspect to things that are popping up. Some more mundane than others, but in any event, it does it does break up the monotony, as it were.
That's the weather, right? Anything can happen with the weather.
That's absolutely right. Which brings me to the point of why weather around here is actually notoriously difficult to forecast, both in terms of one short-term forecast, a five-day outlook or something like that, and the forecasts, say, that come out a month in advance, for instance, the winter forecast we have coming up, and how well that works for this part of the country. And the Mid-Atlantic region is just terrible to try to forecast for. We here in Virginia are often at the confluence of warm and cold air and moist and dry air. And that often means that a small shift in a storm or other factors can make a big difference in the amount, type of precipitation we get, or even whether we get it. And certainly folks that have lived around here understand what winter weather can be like, wherein you don't know if you're going to get rain, snow, freezing rain, sleet, or some hideous combination of all of them, and when it might switch from one to the other. And to try to tell that in advance is extremely difficult, because one's working with these models that only have a limited spatial resolution to them. So you have to make some inferences as to what's going on. And in the long run, it's very, very difficult to get that right. So please, please don't be too harsh on the weather forecasters, especially in the wintertime, because it is very difficult to get all this stuff nailed down. It's there's always a little bit extra. And as we like to say, nature bats last.
Our guest today, Jerry Stinger, he's the director of the climatology office at UVA, 16 minutes after the hour. We will be talking with somebody in just a few minutes who was a customer, I don't know if that's the right word, but who used FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And I think that I always wanted to do that because I think FEMA is viewed as the cavalry, and she's got a different story to tell, or a little more in-depth story to tell. We'll be talking with her in just a few minutes. Jerry, you were talking about nature bats last, and sort of trying to get a handle on predicting the weather. Poor Richard's Almanac popped into my head. How is there in any way is poor Richard's Almanac ever accurate, other than just the guessing percentage?
Well, I'm thinking of the Farmer's Almanac, which is one of the ones that that's pretty popular. Well, it's very interesting. Has lots of good information on it when it comes to the forecast for the upcoming year or so. You have to take that with a block of salt, because the if you look at the way they structure their forecasts. Last time I looked at one, it made the forecast by region, and Virginia was in the same region as Maine. Now, I think I could go out on a limb and predict snow at some point in the third week of January, give or take a few days either side of it, and be pretty confident that I'll do all right on that. And when one looks at the almanac, it's not, I think of it as a good climatology in general, a good general information about the way things often are. But in terms of its longer range forecast, it's a very liberal way of deciding if the forecast is right, and a very general way of making the forecast. So no offense to the folks that create that, but it's set up to have a good chance of being right, even so, I'm afraid.
There's a lot of work being done in the White House with budget cuts, and depending on which article you read, the numbers are different, but the budget cuts themselves are there, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is up for a budget cut. The general number that I came to was approximately 17%, and that would affect the climatology office. So can you talk for a minute about how that would work in your job and in your work?
To tell you the truth, right now, this we have most all the state climatologists and regional climatologists have been talking about this a lot. And the general consensus is we don't know exactly how that's going to go down. If NOAA does get cut, we don't know where they plan to cut their programs. They have all kinds of programs going on. But I would say that 90% of the weather information that we use comes from NOAA sources. They're the folks that run the big data collection networks, either run them or coordinate them. And there are literally thousands of observing stations around the country that take surface measurements, plus, is, of course, they are the upper air measurements that come from several stations around the country. If that sort of information collection and archival is curtailed, that could be a real problem in performing any kind of analyses for anybody, and really cut into the office's ability to respond to people's questions. It, especially if the databases that we are used to get changed around, or in somehow made more difficult to use, or left with lots of gaps. That's a real problem. So we are very concerned about this and how it will affect one of the basic operations of NOAA, which is the coordination of data gathering. And that has been their responsibility since the old Weather Bureau changed from the Department of Agriculture to NOAA many decades back. So this does have us very concerned, and the answer is we really don't know how this is going to shake out, but we're not real, we're a little nervous about it.
All right, we're going to take a break. Jerry Stinger, he's the director of the Climatology Office at UVA's Department of Environmental Science. Jerry, thanks for being with us today. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We'll take our break. We'll come back, and I think we're going to have our guest on to talk about FEMA and get her view on her personal experience with FEMA. Hang tight, folks. All right. Thanks for being with us today, folks. It's a beautiful Sunday here in Charlottesville. Now we're going to talk about FEMA with our guest, Karen. And we are ready to go. Karen, are you with us?
Yes.
Karen experienced FEMA back in 2003. She was somebody who suffered through Hurricane Isabel down in Hampton Roads, September 18, 2003. Karen, tell us a little bit about your story.
Sure. We knew a hurricane was on the way, and we had small children, had a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old, and my husband and I talked about, you know, what the plan was, whether we were going to stay or leave. Ultimately, a long story short, with lots of changes in the forecast, a pretty quick decision was made for me and the kids to leave, and he was going to stay. And the hurricane hit, and we ended up with about 18 inches of water inside the house, and pretty much, you know, from there, we just about everything was destroyed, from either soaking up the water or, you know, sitting in the water, and you know, we had to start the process of carrying out everything from the 4-foot mark of the sheetrock down to the floor, and you know, make flood insurance claims, homeowners insurance claims for a little bit of wind damage, and figure out where we were going to live and what we were going to do.
Now, I don't want to make it seem like too little, but 18 inches of water inside, can you give me a mental picture of where that is? Because for a lot of people, when you hear the stories compared to Houston, and they're talking about, you know, 50-some inches of rain, et cetera, how much water was in your city? How much, you know, 18 inches? It's like, well, okay, on a ruler.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there was probably somewhere between 3.5 to 4 feet of water in the city. 18 inches inside of a house goes up above the electrical outlets. So, you know, the house is not raised up high, like at the beach. It's a normal, you know, we probably have about a, at the time, we probably had about a 2.5 to 3 foot, you know, cinder block foundation, like just about any house has. So then when you add in the fact that there was 18 inches of water inside the house, that's feet of water standing. You know, when you think about where your house, to actually walk into it from up your 3 or 4 stairs and then add 18 inches inside your living room, that's above your electrical outlets. That's a lot of water.
And so all the water in your house, by the time you take 3 or 4 steps to get inside, and then all the water got inside your electrical outlets.
Mm-hmm.
So it ruins. Yes. Okay. All right. Thanks.
That ruins all the appliances, all the electrical outlets. Yeah. It's a mess.
Okay. So now you have to start dealing with, so FEMA comes to save the day.
Right.
Because that's what they do. I mean, as far for the stereotype and what most people expect, and again, this conversation isn't to, the conversation that we're having with Karen isn't to speak poorly of the individuals who work for FEMA, but Karen, I would like you to tell us about your experience with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, because I do believe, after talking with you, that for some people, they don't understand the whole experience with FEMA.
Right. So, you know, in the first couple of days after the storm, there's still no electricity. You can't use your water. And, I mean, at that point, we had nowhere to live because everything in the house is wet. We're having to tear out sheetrock to the studs, tear out insulation, take out the kitchen cabinets, every appliance in the house. You can't, even if there had been electricity, we couldn't have turned it on because all of the electrical outlets had salt water in them. So there was a fire hazard. We're pulling out the carpeting, taking up subfloor. So literally it's half a house from about the 4 foot mark up. Everything looks normal, but the 4 foot mark down to the floor, it's just studs in the outer walls. And, you know, of course we had somewhat prepared, as you're told to do, to, you know, to be without water and electricity for 3 to 4 days. But the entire city was, you know, pretty much shut down. There's only so much you can do with a cooler. If you can't get ice from the convenience store, how do you keep the food cold? If you don't have electricity and you've used up all the charcoal or the propane in your grill, how do you cook the food? And we had a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old. So then FEMA comes, and we're told, you know, go to this church where they were set up and you know, go through the process, and FEMA's going to help you, and they're going to give you money for your immediate needs. You know, get a hotel room or possibly rent an apartment. There were ice distributions. We had to go sit in our car in line. We had to have proof of residency, and we were given bags of ice to, you know, continue trying to keep our food safe to eat. And they were giving away bread and you know, non-perishable things. And so my husband left at the house trying to, you know, tear things out and sort through everything. And I went to the church to meet with the FEMA people and, you know, with hundreds of other people, and we're sitting and we're waiting and we're filling out applications, and we meet with a person who tells us, you know, here's what FEMA will do. Well, if you don't have flood insurance, FEMA will, you know, offer you assistance. Well, we had flood insurance, but we did not have contents coverage on our flood insurance, which we didn't find out until after the hurricane had happened and we made the claim.
You didn't have what insurance?
We didn't have contents coverage. So the house was covered for flood damage, but none of the contents of the house were covered for flood damage.
So you mean like the sofa and the TV and the stove?
The clothes, the shoes,
Okay.
All the kids' school supplies. I mean, nothing that was actually inside the house that wasn't our structural part of the house was covered from the flood insurance. So, and we didn't know that. It wasn't, you know, when we bought the house, we were first-time home buyers, and no one explained it to us, and we got what they told us we had to have, which was flood insurance coverage. And that's what we did. But that flood insurance coverage only covered fixing the structure of the house. So FEMA was supposed to come in and, you know, and give us money and help us to actually replace all of these things and give us money so we could buy food and we could, you know, buy cleaning supplies because mold is an issue. Once you've had water inside of a closed up house, you know, mold grows really quickly. And so we were supposed to be able to buy cleaning supplies and buy food and maybe rent an apartment. Or if we'd had trees down, we could have purchased a chainsaw to, you know, to clean up the property, those kinds of things.
Okay, and, but you didn't rent an apartment.
No, I did not. We took the, I think FEMA gave us somewhere around just shy of $2,000, like $1,800 and some change. We ended up going to live with my parents for a few weeks. One of the things that FEMA will do is offer you temporary housing in the form of a, like a camper, they call them travel trailers, but they're those like fifth wheel campers that you pull behind a vehicle. And so we applied for that because the house we were staying in actually had a tree leaning against it and it wasn't safe either. So we applied for the housing assistance through FEMA, and they brought, within a few days of applying, this travel trailer to our house and parked it in the front yard and hooked it up. It had a propane tank for heat and air, and you could do a little bit of cooking, and they hooked it up to the sewer so that we could you know, use the shower and the bathroom in the trailer. And we lived in that trailer for, and we moved out in January, and Isabel was in September. So we lived in a camper in our front yard with a two adults, two kids. My husband was going through the police academy at the time, so he was studying and you know.
He lived in that trailer for 4 months.
Yeah. Yep. And then once,
including Christmas.
Yes, including Christmas, we were in the camper for Christmas. And right around that time is when I got the letter from FEMA requesting back all of the money that they had given us within the first few days after the hurricane had happened. The money that supposedly was given to us so that we could buy food and, you know, have a place to live and, you know, clean up our property and things like that. They were requesting it back. And I couldn't understand why I needed to give this money back. I mean, I had used that money. We had spent it. We had, you know, done what we were needed to do. And after numerous phone calls and we actually, I met with someone with the city who was trying to help people through this process. And that's when we found out that the money wasn't a gift. It was a loan. And they were demanding it to be paid back within a couple of weeks of being notified that we had to pay it back unless I could produce receipts or I could, you know, somehow prove what the money had been spent on. But we weren't told at the time that we needed to do those kinds of things. We weren't told we needed to document what the money was spent on. Not to mention the fact that we're, you know, we're displaced out of our house. We're living out of a small suitcase because almost everything is, you know, is ruined or destroyed and had to be thrown out. And you know, well, keeping track of receipts that I spent at the store for groceries or, you know, clothes for the kids to go back to school was not one of the priorities that I had in the forefront of my mind at the time. You know, I hadn't been told I needed to do it, so I wasn't doing it. And so at that point, it was too little too late after I got a letter that said, pay us back all the money that we lent to you. And so that was very eye-opening. And you know, we tried to fight it and found out that just about everyone was having the same, you know, the same issue. the very few people that had met with FEMA representatives who are volunteers, you know, had been told that the money was a loan and not a gift, and had been told that they needed to document what it had been spent on so that later on we could prove we had spent it on, you know, necessary things in a direct relation to the hurricane. So I had to pay almost all of it back. I think I managed to produce receipts for about $240 worth of what I spent just by luck, and had to pay the rest of it back.
Karen on the phone with us talking about her experience with FEMA after Hurricane Isabel in September of 2003. As we talk about weather today, Jerry Stinger here, Director of Climatology Office at UVA, with us as well. Karen, your experience with FEMA when you see a hurricane like what's going on in Puerto Rico and people asking where's FEMA, what runs through your mind?
That they're going to be very surprised that FEMA is not the white knight coming to the rescue that they think it is. It's just, it seems like a great thing at the time, but it's really, you know, they're not able to do what the perception out there is, which is to come save everyone. We're going to give you the money you need to fix up your house. You know, we're going to make sure that everything's okay, and that's just not how it ends up working. It's a government agency, and I don't want to sound like a, you know, government, I'm anti-government or anything like that, but it's a government agency run like all other government agencies. There's a lot of red tape. There's a lot of rules and regulations, and as a person who doesn't deal with the government on a regular basis, I was unaware of those, and the volunteers who work for FEMA who go to these areas that are, you know, devastated by, you know, hurricanes or tornadoes or what have you, those volunteers are no more knowledgeable about the rules and regulations a lot of times than we, the normal population, are. And they don't, you know, they don't have those tools and that knowledge, and they don't pass on that information because they don't have it either.
Right.
So I feel sorry for them. I do. I feel like, you think this is going to be the state, this is what's going to save you, and it's not. It's a temporary, very small little Band-Aid, but it's not going to be.
I think that they often get the training of a few hours before they're sent out to help. Karen, hang tight. Our guest, Jerry, has a comment that he wants to share about Isabel as well. Jerry, you wanted to talk about Hurricane Isabel.
I did not have any dealings with FEMA, but it is an interesting corollary to what was going on. My mom lived in Richmond area at that time, and ironically enough, my dad's funeral was the day before Isabel came through, so my mom, being in her late 70s, was pretty distraught by all this, and I spent the night there when the winds were at their highest, and we watched trees go down all over the place. Fortunately, her house didn't get hit by one, but so much of the power went out that she was without power for almost 3 weeks before it was finally restored. She had no phone, so I actually went out in the backyard, found the wires from the pole, and spliced them together myself to get her phone working at least. And unfortunately, I needed to be back here in Charlottesville to help man the climatology office. We had roped a couple of students into helping us out with that regarding questions related to the storm. A lot of them came from the state emergency management agency, not from FEMA, but they were mostly doing data collection and analysis of what happened. So I was back and forth there, and it was a pretty traumatic time. My mom was also without water for a long time, and I would have to come back and forth and bring her supplies. And it was a pretty traumatic period. We didn't have to worry about dealing with FEMA. We didn't have water coming into the house. The roof was intact and no rising water, but it was a pretty traumatic period even so. And the power outages around the state was just phenomenal. They were bringing in power of maintenance crews from many states away. You often see these trucks with Georgia license plates or something like that. So it was the most massive power outage in the state of Virginia, and it affected a lot of people, not as badly as the folks who are near the coast, but it had a big effect.
Karen, thanks so much for participating in the show.
Sure.
All right. We're going to take a break now, and we'll come back and finish the show, the last segment, with Jerry. All right. Back to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, WPVC 94.7. Rick Moore here. Our guest today, as we talk about weather, Jerry Stinger, Director of the Climatology Office. And thanks to Karen for talking about Federal Emergency Management Agency. And again, the people who volunteer for that, the goal was not to talk poorly about them, but not everybody sees how FEMA continues and sort of the second part of FEMA after they arrive. And that was the purpose of bringing Karen on. And so hopefully folks listening to today's program and podcast understand that. So, Jerry, let's talk a little bit about, you have mentioned several times now about how Virginia and the Mid-Atlantic are sort of at this crux and how we get a little bit of everything. So I was sort of doing my homework for the show. I was looking to see what sort of weather we've gotten in the last decade. And I found that in the last decade, we've gotten a hurricane, tornado, deadly tornado, winter storms, multiple winter storms of 12 to 24 inches, floods, both coastal floods and river floods, droughts, which we'll talk about. We're currently going through local drought warnings or watches, earthquake. So let's talk about a little bit of all of those. Let's start with the drought.
Well, my summary on all that would be welcome to Virginia. And what's interesting is when doing statistical climatology, we find that the more you look at things, the more time that passes, the more things you find that are somewhat anomalous or record setting. It's just part of what happens as you analyze things more and more. One good example of the way things have changed is when we look at tornadoes. We see, if we look at all tornadoes, we see an increase in the number of tornadoes in Virginia over time. But when we look at just moderately strong tornadoes up, in this case, we take out the F0 and F1 tornadoes, the weak ones. We don't see that. And part of it is we are always improving the way that we can analyze weather. We have the ability to go out or the Weather Service has the ability to go out and look for tornadic damage. We have Doppler radar, which can show us the signature of tornadoes. And armed with that, with GPS, and with more people populating the state in areas that used to be fairly remote, we spot a lot of things and document a lot of things that we really couldn't before. So that's one of the complicating factors. And when people have tried to put together analyses of this, they don't really come up with anything that shows change in tornadoes. And that's rather typical of a lot of things that we see. We did have a record snowy winter in, as I recall, it was 2009-2010. That was some 55 inches of snowfall. Again, a record. But it still seems to be going along with the variability that we've seen in Virginia weather over time. And the drought of record is still from 1930 in Virginia, where it was, I think, on the order of 20-some inches of precipitation we had here, normal being about 48. So that was incredibly dry year. One of the interesting things is that that relates to the drought conditions we're having now, is that in Virginia, or in particularly eastern Virginia, the normal amount of rainfall in September is highly affected by the amount of tropical moisture that comes in. About 30-40% of the normal precipitation then is from tropical sources. Now, there have been some killer tropical storms or hurricanes this year, but in terms of their effect on Virginia, it's been relatively small. And this is probably one of the things that has contributed to the very dry conditions we have right now. And if I may expound upon the drought conditions a little bit, one of the very significant things in determining how your water supplies are going to go in a given year is based upon the amount of precipitation that comes down during the colder portion of the year, basically October through March.
You're talking about snow melt.
Oh, well, not necessarily. We don't. Most of our precip in Virginia during the winter is rain. Snowfall, remember, if we get a foot of, we get 10 inches of snow, that's usually about 1 inch of water. So most of our precipitation is rainfall. Now, snow does usually have a particularly good chance of soaking down into the ground rather than running off. So it is a little bit more beneficial in that regard. But actually, it's those nasty days where there's long-term cold rain that you just hate. But that's what saves us, because during the colder part of the year, the water has a chance to percolate down through the topsoil layers into the deeper soil and groundwater system before it's evaporated or before plants take it up. So we're not in the middle of the growing season, so the plants aren't sucking the water out of the topsoil like crazy. Once we get into the warmer part of the year, once the growing season starts, we start losing moisture on average. So on average, we get more moisture than the loss during the colder part of the year, and vice versa in the warmer part of the year. So the recharge during those colder months is absolutely critical, because if you don't get it then, the chances of getting a recharge later on are pretty slim, unless you get a massive amount of water. This year, for instance, the period October through March, we only had about 63% of normal precipitation. That ain't good, basically. And in the summertime, we only had about 50% of normal rainfall. And in the last couple of months, we still only have about 50%. We've had a couple of fairly wet years in there, wet months in there that have helped us limp along. But it's not surprising that we're having some problems right now, that the drought task force, the state drought task force to which I belong, issued a drought watch for this region. And when you look, it's one of the big indicators is the groundwater condition. And there's a monitoring well of pretty high quality up in Orange, Virginia. And that is a good indication, not perfect, but a good indication of the groundwater conditions in this area. And they are, I think the best term is abysmal. They are down near record low levels and have been bouncing around that for several months. That's one of the big concerns right now, is it looks like our groundwater is not doing too well. And an interesting thing to note is that when you look at the South Brevana Reservoir, it has a certain amount of, excuse me, obvious storage capacity. But most of the water that's drawn from that, or at least a large proportion of it, is groundwater. Because as that water comes off the surface, it is replaced by the groundwater surrounding it. And, of course, when it fills up, it pushes water into the groundwater system. So an indication that you have a shortage of flow from that doesn't just mean that you're that it's a plastic-lined cup. It means that you're drawing out groundwater, and you're having a big effect on what sort of resources you have available.
Yeah, I drive over the reservoir every day, and you can see how low it is. And it is not a pretty sight. We just had the stop, drop, and roll test in this week, correct? I believe for the earth, the stop, drop, and roll test came across my cell phone, and that's because of the earthquake.
There was an earthquake drill.
Right, the earthquake drill.
Yes.
And I think for many people, I mean, we had an earthquake in this decade. You know, you talk about the fact that, okay, so we've had a lot of winter storms. Oh, we've had some earthquakes. Really? We have tornadoes here in Virginia? Okay, so we have drought. But gosh, we've had an earthquake.
Well, there's certainly been earthquakes of various levels.
That's
certainly
a serious
earthquake. Yeah, it was nearly a 6 on the Richter scale, which is quite significant. I remember actually when happened.
I mean, for many people who lived here, you can go, I know where I was when that hit. I mean, it was that type of earthquake. That was a where were you sort of event.
Well, not being a big expert on earthquakes, usually whatever it is, once it hits the ground, that's it for me. But I do get asked about earthquakes when there's an earthquake for some reason. A lot of the people that call me about weather decide he must know about earthquakes. So I do have to do a little brushing up on that. But one of the things is I think it's becoming better realize that we are not in an earthquake-free zone here, that we do have some faults, so to speak, that are subject to slippage and bringing us some earthquakes. Whether or not this portends more activity is unknown, but it is a bit disconcerting to have had that happen.
56 minutes after the hour. Just a couple minutes left with our guest today, Jerry Stinger, as we talk about the weather. Jerry's with the Climatology Office, a director at UVA's Department of Environmental Science. Jerry, are climatologists asked by our governor or the office at his office with new projects when he's trying to bring in new businesses about how they might affect the state?
Well, I'll put it this way. I'm not sure how they get directed to us. I think there's a economic development office in the state that will sometimes send people to us. A classic example is some years back, I had somebody call us. He was interested in putting in a golf course in some location in Central Virginia, and they tried to get funding for it, and the people they went to for funding said, no, they looked at the data and said, you can't play golf there, that's no good. Well, I wound up doing an analysis that showed that at the time of day people usually play golf, it's actually quite fine, and that they were very concerned about the amount of rainfall in Central Virginia. And I pointed out that during the summer, a lot of times this has to do with thunderstorms passing through, often in the afternoon, and sometimes they're short-lived, and concluded that we had less problem with that than we do in Florida, and there are plenty of golf courses in Florida that seem to do just fine. And I think they got their funding for it and built the course.
Last question. How does the governor decide to announce a state of emergency, and are you involved?
Regarding drought, I'm part of the drought task force, and it's the governor's drought task force. So we get together every month or more often to discuss these things and come up with a set of general recommendations as to what should be done. And we, the task force puts together a report that suggests drought watch or warning for a certain area. And I don't know if that then goes to the governor's office or what for the final proclamation, but that's the main way we interface with the governor's office is in that particular situation. There's also, for a lot of big emergencies, there's the State Emergency Management Office, and they're a big operation, and they can get a lot of stuff done, and they sometimes ask me about some of the input, but they've got a pretty big, pretty responsive organization for big things.
All right, Jerry, thanks so much for coming on today. Will you come back?
If I have to, sure.
We'll have you on when there's some big weather coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jerry Stinger from the Climatology Office, where he's the director at UVA's Department of Environmental Science. Next week, Sean McCord on to talk about the Virginia Film Festival. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.